follow that, I guess.
Yeah, it was pretty random, right?
So we're going to have a conversation. I liked a phrase I heard earlier this evening, which is a commitment to improvisation. So it's a sort of conversation without a tightrope, right? So we just see where we go. So what I'm interested in really is these attitudes to chance and randomness that were sort of captured in that performance, but also in scientific practice and outside scientific practice. So Helena, maybe we could start with the synthetic biology that you are involved in, yeah, and the kind of way that chance shows up in various ways.
Yeah, so working with biological materials is really beautiful and really messy because our material and the subject of study is intrinsically subject to variation, and there's a lot of random processes happening, whether it's in our bodies, in our cells, and in at the level of populations as well. If you take the example of a simple cell, you could say that it's just a bunch of molecules moving around randomly and encountering each other and interacting with each other. And at the same time, it's really interesting to think how all this Brownian motion from that emerges complex structures and functions that seem so perfectly designed. And so biology, it's full with variation. And so it took us a while to understand how these very complex systems work and make sense out of them, right? And so thanks to things like computational modeling, we could find stable patterns that are there that are sort of like deterministic, right? That you can write an equation to say when you make these things interact with each other, you get this output. And so the system rationale really try to give this mathematical description of nature. And in some ways, it was pretty successful because indeed we can, using mathematics and modeling, we can describe how networks of molecules inside a cell can interact. And so we got really excited and then, if you understand how a network works, how these things interact with each other and the feedbacks, then in theory you can also direct the system towards a specific direction that you want. And that's how like a little bit the synthetic biology feel was born, which is that you will provoke things artificially inside cells to make a specific end. And so, well, that is very beautiful, but it's not true. what happens is that most of the time, so indeed we can provoke the system to go towards a specific direction, but biological systems are in constant motion, they are dynamic, and so at some point they escape our control. And so that's what frustrates a lot of physicists and a lot of mathematicians and computer scientists that got interested in biology. But at the same time, I think it makes us realize how actually contextual those and dynamic these systems are. And so maybe we need to understand that they are in constant motion and that, so contingency is there.
So there's a tension right there between a kind of engineering control ambition, that the lab has to be a place where we extinguish variation and randomness so that we have some security in the results that we're getting, tensioned against a sense that randomness, mutation, stochasticity is maybe the source of some of the interesting order in those systems, and so we want to have both worlds. And to me, watching the performance, I think a lot of the intrigue of that performance is on the same tension, right, between the fact that there's randomness and therefore jeopardy, it might go wrong, but there's also a sense that that the whole thing revolves around the fact that it won't go wrong, that there is control somehow.
Exactly, it could have gone wrong, and then I would be very embarrassed.
But we'd be having a different conversation.
We'll be having a very different conversation. Yeah. Well, there was a plan B for a different ending. But again, this is about how we want to control situations, and yeah. You're talking about how computer scientists feel very frustrated, and I think it just, I mean, what I was very interested in doing this little experiment was to, well, first problematize randomness in the perspective of experience. I think we as human beings, our human condition is terribly, terribly bad at accepting random events. That's why we see patterns. That's why we see relationships, very complex relationships, etc. I think we cannot cope with that. We can accept randomness, perhaps in certain events. We're talking just about if I throw coins to the floor, we are okay with the fact that the coins are going to be distributed unevenly in random ways. Some will be up, some down, etc. But when it comes to the, to a tragedy where 100 people die, we don't accept it as, well, things happen. It was a bad day. We want to find the reasons. Yeah. Why is that happening? So again, there's a tension between that and how we control sometimes the outcomes, and that's what divination, prediction practices. Mm-hmm. There are so many with ashes and fire. That's what they do, trying to be in control of the process of the
fate.
Outcome,
yeah.
The fate, to give us, I don't know, calmness.
Mm-hmm. So I mean, I think that's. Part of the reason why the book of a million random digits is amusing is the hubris of attempting to capture randomness and pin it down in a book. Yeah. And that book is a real book, and you can buy it on Amazon. And it's one of a small number of things that are sold on Amazon that are famous because of the reviews that are written of them. And there's a series of extremely funny reviews of this book.
The best reviews, you have to read them.
And the humor turns on that hubris and on the inappropriateness of using a book as a vehicle for randomness. Mm-hmm. So there are jokes like that tell you who did it at the end, right? So you don't have to read the book because they tell you the last digit. It turns out it was number 9.
Yeah.
And other jokes about the fact that there are errors and someone points out that on this page, a 7 should really be a 3.
And better than the film.
But I think they reveal something that's quite a sort of... a deep appreciation there about randomness, and sort of the very fact that people can make those jokes is revealing something about our attitude to randomness and stochasticity, which I think is really interesting. So the reason why Rand Corporation invested so much money in that is that we're very bad at generating random numbers ourselves, and an exercise that I have done with undergraduates is I can get them to write a little computer program that simulates a neural network, a little learning algorithm, and it's only got maybe 3 nodes, a tiny, simple neural network. And I get them to play against that neural network. They play scissors, paper, stone. I don't know whether you know that game, right? Where the best strategy is to behave randomly, right? You play scissors, and you don't want to give a cue, right, that you're going to play scissors, because then your opponent can play the appropriate response. And what people find is that the neural network will gradually get better than them at playing that game, because it will pick up on the fact that people are not very good at generating a random series of scissors, paper, stone. They tend to not generate the same move many times in a row, right? So scissors, scissors, scissors feels an extremely unlikely thing to play, and people don't play it enough. So there's a bias in people that we're not very good at sort of at understanding what randomness really looks like, and we're not very good at generating it.
Yeah.
Which I think maybe some magic performances kind of maybe rely on that, right? That you can take advantage of that bias. And certainly casinos take advantage of that bias, right? So the gambler's fallacy, it's come up red, I've lost on red 3 times in a row. Surely, what are the chances that I can lose again the 4th time?
the same.
Well, it's the same chance as before, but it doesn't feel like that to the gambler, unfortunately. So, do you think that science, the synthetic biology that you do, is ready to fully embrace that kind of spontaneous randomness, or because it's an engineering field, is it always going to want to hold it at arm's length?
Well, we like to say that it's an engineering field to feel in control, but I think it's more like experimenting with the system, and then somehow we get lucky, and then we finally find what we want. But in science, there is usefulness to kind of like accepting this randomness and stochastic events. For example, if you're talking about computational biology, indeed, including a random factor in your model mathematically sometimes matches more with reality. So instead of being super deterministic, then you accept that there are randomness behind it, and then you get something that looks more like the real picture. And so that's more from the theoretical side. More from the practical side, well, actually, like, so I'm a biologist, so I work with bacteria, et cetera. And so sometimes you want to go from a point A to a point B. So the engineering logic is like, I want to get to point B. And so we're not that good at it sometimes, because we can guide ourselves thanks to models, but then we do whatever we think is going to make us go to point B, and then it doesn't work. And so what we do is that, well, we just basically imitate nature, which is nature generates randomness and generates variability. And so what we do is either we increase the probability space, so we just imitate nature by generating randomness as well. If I can give a very simple example, so imagine that you have in my case, like, I work with peptides, which is just like amino acid sequences, and then we saw that if you change these three amino acids in this region, then the activity of this peptide will change. Either it will be more efficient or less efficient. And so we want to get to a more efficient point, and so we have no idea how to get there. So what we do is, like, we randomize these three peptides. And so by doing so, we create a lot of variability, and then as engineers, we make tools to try to find that specific variant. So we're going more high throughput in biology, and by going more high throughput, we increase the probability space.
So one of the things that relies on is our ability to know it when we see it. So we're the generative part of the creative process is being randomized, but the filtering and the selective part, it's like we
is what we decide.
That's the one we want, right? And you mentioned divination. That seems like, to me, there must be something similar there, that we throw yarrow sticks down or we toss coins to determine which page of the I Ching we're going to read. And it could be, there's only a small number, really. I mean, it's not to capture the entirety of all the questions that humankind might ask. A small book has got a number of pages, and we find a random page. But the way that it works is that we spot something in the passages that we read. So really, we had the kind of answer in ourselves, I think, is the idea.
Yeah, exactly. And who's to blame in that case? Gravity?
Yes, well, when we toss the yarrow, no one is to blame. I mean, maybe that's also a useful thing, right?
Exactly. I mean, that's human nature replying.
We can make a decision.
Ultimately, who's in control?
Yeah.
And again, what I mentioned before is, like, what if we live in a very random universe? And this very random.
We live
indeed.
In a very random universe, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because the first discussion in this session. There was a claim that we don't actually live in a random universe, that really we live in a universe where everything that happens, there is a reason. It's just that many of those reasons we don't sufficiently care about to dig down and find them. And so when a company makes a new drug, they might test it on a random sample of the population, and they might pick random numbers from the special book in order to make sure that it's a proper random sample of the population. But that's only because they can't afford to test it on everybody carefully, and it's because they don't care about the difference between you and me. They just care about, on average, that it would be okay for us. And you could imagine if the police said that that's the way they were going to approach solving really serious crimes, that they were just going to knock on random doors until they found something that worked, we'd tell them that's not right, right? They have to care more than that. They have to behave like detectives and piece together a story. But drug companies don't have to behave like detectives and piece together a story for each drug. They're allowed to be indiscriminate and random. Or, well, it's a defensible randomness, right? But it's still averaging over us. And there's, I think, again, in this, the response to this million random digits book, there is a sense that, that the randomness is a source of inhumanity, right? It's a way to to average over us, blend us together. And that certainly since 1948 has been a trend in the adoption of mathematical and physics ideas in the social sciences, possibly. Okay, where to next in this conversation? One of the things that occurred to me, there's a nice experiment that economists do called the ultimatum game, where two people play a game, and they can either play as player one or player two, like a video game. And you choose it at random. So you pick two people, they don't know each other, they're random people, in the ideal version of the game. And one of them gets to be player one, maybe you toss a coin. And the game is very simple. You put £100 or €100 on the table, and the player one offers some of them to player two, and player two gets to decide whether to keep them. It sounds like a trick game, right? So player one might offer 60 or might offer 10, and player two gets to decide whether they want that money. But if they say no, the money is destroyed. If they say yes, they take the portion that was offered, and the remainder goes to player one. So it's a game about fairness and generosity. And in the normal version of the game, when the two players are picked at random, if I'm player two and someone only offers me €1, then maybe I'll just make all the money burn, right? That's a rude thing to do to me. Why should he get 99 and I get one? But if instead of doing it at random, you decide who gets to be player one based on a game of skill, so first of all, you play some game, then actually I'm prepared to accept a much lower offer on average when people run these experiments, because I judge that there's a reason why.
Yeah, because you're biased, right? And then.
But that randomness—it means that we have an attitude to randomness, which is that, which is implicit in that result, right? That that fairness and randomness have a relationship to each other, which is.
I guess we always try to find like relationships because, like, we like to, like we were saying, control our fate, right? We like to find the cause of a specific effect, because if we don't like the effect, then by removing the cause, then it's not going to happen. And so we sort of like reduce the chance that it will happen. And if we like the effect, then we will like push it, make that happen, increase our chance for that to happen, right?
So and sorry.
No. I just want to add something that actually is the reason why I'm here. In one of the early conversations I had with Sasha Polep, when he was curating this section, I mentioned that one of the greatest magicians, David Berglas, an English magician, he had he came up with this magic trick, which is like the holy grail of performance magic, called any card, any number. Which is basically someone says a number within the deck of cards, and somebody else says a type of card. So when you count the number of cards that someone said, the resulting card will be the card that the other person said. So for people that know magic, they know that it's impossible to do that without sleight of hand. And he did it without sleight of hand. And later on, one of his students wrote a book about how this magic trick works. And the result is a 500-page explaining, not the trick, because it's an impossible trick after all, but it's more about exactly how identifying opportunities or accidents and framing them as what you actually wanted to show, but actually things just happen, and
provoking
things just happen
your
all
chance,
the time.
For it to happen.
Exactly. So it's all about how you present it in this case in your benefit.
In science, we also do that, right? I mean, we also try to increase our chances of success. And in our practice, well, it has a beautiful name called serendipity, right? That that is like a fruitful encounter that is almost random, that voila, the key, Eureka. And so it's a beautiful way also to do science. So most of the time people think that science is a very, whether it's biology or anything else, it's very directed, very very linear in practice, when actually we're just like playing around with stuff. And then sort of like by learning in the way, we try to increase our chance of succeeding, and we choose different directions until it is there. And then...
So it starts off superstitious. We have to do the experiment in this lab.
Yeah,
in Japan,
yeah. So they, in biology, there's a lot of black magic. like also, like my students, they're like, "Oh, you did this PCR and it works," and like we've been trying. I'm like, magic, magic hands. But like,
yeah. Or you have to use the right pipette, right?
Yeah, and so once we find something that works, sometimes we don't even know why, but we know it will work, and we just transmit that practical knowledge.
But there's a strong survivor effect.
So because there's a strong survivor effect.
We live now in a world where you know, something extremely rare can happen, something trivial but rare, and suddenly it's all over the internet. So kids flipping bottles and the bottle lands. But you don't see the 1,000 that were flipped didn't work. YouTube just shows you the one that succeeded. Yeah. So we have a generation of kids growing up in a world where these things are possible, right?
Yeah.
Whereas
it's the same in science. Yeah. I mean, you read the scientific paper and you're like, "Oh my God, this person is amazingly smart." But actually, they don't show the millions of PhD students that that were behind trying all kinds of stuff.
It's like when you watch the wrong videos of kids playing with a knife and the hands, no? Like, they go awfully wrong.
Well, so there's that risk taking. So chance and risk taking, accidents, this sort of negative connotations of chance, and the propensity to take risks. Teenage men in particular, in every culture, there's this massive peak of deaths by accident around the mid-teenage to late teenage years, just because our brains are not set up to protect us from those risks when we're going through some critical teenage period. And that's really well understood. But presumably there are other weird risk-taking biases that are that take place in the 50s when politicians are making decisions about the future of the countries that they run. So the fact that they're not drawing random numbers from a book of carefully balanced, perfectly rational random numbers, they're just relying on the risk-taking devices that evolution gave us seems very scary. So there are many, many science labs across the world all trying to do the same things, but we have a much smaller number of countries and planets trying to do reasonable things. We can't afford that kind of parallelism to be the way that we solve these problems. This attitude to chance, the positives associated with it, that it's about a source of creativity and kind of sparks and sort of wondrous breakthroughs and new techniques, you know, new equipment being used in random
ways.
Yeah,
source of variability, right? And then the more diversity you have, whether it's in the biological population or whether it's in the creative process, generating variability always comes with the generation of novelty.
But the negative is you don't want to be the hopeful monster that is terrible, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to be the mutant that has the bad mutation. So the universities that I've worked at often think that interdisciplinarity is a fantastic thing, but when you talk to individual academics, they would all rather someone else did it, right? Because it's hard. They want to carry on just being a physicist. They think interdisciplinarity is great, but they'd rather export that to somebody else's job. And there's something similar. Variability and randomness and exploration is fantastic, but 99 out of 100 of those
are probably not.
Don't make it. Don't work. Which is fine in a lab of little test tubes. Yeah. We don't really care so much about the 99 test tubes. But when that spills over into politics, into economics, then things are
or to health, and things like cancer and things like this that are that emerge randomly, right? That we can't control, and that when it happens to us, it's like we don't want to be that mutation that it happens. Yeah.
Okay, I think we are being drawn to a close, and we can hand over to the next speaker. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.